Good. So now we have any questions. Very good. The first question. You once said that if one wants to do kusina, one should put metta into the meditation so that if one has a nimitta, it will be soft and gentle. Question. How about putting air kusina into breath meditation? The air kusina into breath meditation? Yeah, I suppose you could do that. Kusina is usually a visual object. So the usual kusina meditations is you usually take an object and it's just usually a disc and different colours, look at it, and so you can actually visualise it. And then that visual object, you can see it for a long period of time with your eyes open, just the same with your eyes closed. And from there it gets into a nimitta. It's like a fast way to get into a nimitta, but you have to be able to hold an object for a long time. It's a difficult way to do get into nimittas, but some people have that ability. They're just very visual people. So I think when somebody asked me, should I do this, I think I put up a finger, close your eyes, now how long can you visualize that for? And if it's only for a few seconds, it's not long enough. You've got to really have a very strong visual mind. With an air kusina, that is something much more difficult because, what is the color of the air? It just leaves a bit too much there, but if you can just get the qualities of air, if you can imagine those, and if it makes the breath easier to look at, in other words, it gives you something else which you can make the breath more interesting, then fine. What I have tried, which works really, really well, is to put metta into breath meditation, and that is really powerful. Simply because, you can actually look at the breath as like a being. We call it anthropomorphism, taking a non-human object and giving it human qualities. So I sometimes look at my breath, I never say thank you enough to my breathing. It's been going in and out of my body ever since I was born. Even when I'm busy, if I'm sick, when I'm sleeping, it goes in and out all the time, my most reliable friend, and I never really said thank you to it. So thank you, breath. And have this beautiful idea of like friendship and kindness and appreciation to your breathing. And of course, that makes it so wonderful to watch. Whatever you have loving kindness towards, such as a teddy bear, is so easy to hug. So just like the breath, the metta towards the breath really puts a lot of strength into it. Air kusina to breath meditation, I've never done that myself. I'm not really quite understand how that works, but give it a try. See what happens. How does one know what to let go of? When meditating, I try to be nice to myself, but being a deluded worldling, I think I'm mostly chasing pleasant feelings. Help! So if it is mental feelings, in other words, feelings which are associated with the sixth sense, then go and chase them. If it's what they call niramisa, which is nothing to do with the world, such as inspiration, the joy of seeing so many people here meditating, that inspiration of seeing all the people who come to feed you every day, and they just come in from town. This is supposed to be the free holiday day today, and many people came today in their cars, took the time off to bring you food today. Oh, and that's so inspiring. That joy and happiness is niramisa. It's nothing to do with the world, but to do with inspiration, with the mind. That you should never let go of, but you should cultivate. As the Buddha said, the happiness of the mind, the unworldly happinesses, you should not be afraid of, you should follow, develop, make much of. He said that so many times, and it's such an important teaching when I heard that, that there are some pleasures you should be chasing, that I even remembered it in Pali. That happiness, nabayita bang, should not be afraid. For those of you from Indonesia, Malaysia, the bahasa baya, you know, this is to be afraid, fear. Now, this might danger, like a was. So, it's nabayita bang, not to be afraid of. Bahwaita bang, it should be developed. Bahulikata bang, made much of. And asewita bang, to be followed. So those feelings you should follow, you not let go of. As I often say, people think that Buddhists should always be letting go of everything. And that is wrong. As I often tell people, if you are, okay, this is in Thailand this time, if you are on the back of a motorbike going down Sukhumvit Road, do not let go. Be attached. Until you get to the destination. So, what you let go of is the Atagalamatanu Yoga, those things which tire your body, and also those things which are sensory indulgences, or the five senses. The sixth sense, you develop that happiness and that joy. That is the path. Dear Ajahn, there is a chronic pain through much of this body. I'm getting more skillful at letting go of aversion and bringing up some equanimity. However, I'm not yet able to bring real kindness into play. The door of my heart is not opening more than a tiny crack sometimes. It is hard to find kind words for this painful body. May I be well and happy is not convincing believing. I love you just the way you are isn't true. Perhaps you can suggest something helpful. Thank you. If your body is painful, as they say, your body will be painful, but your mind doesn't have to be painful. It's understanding what the Buddha called the two arrows or the two thorns. There was two parts to pain, and some neurologists told me that actually there are two pathways to feeling. One goes to one part of the brain, another goes to the other part of the brain. One is physical, one is the mental. That, you know, there's actually a physical correspondence to what the Buddha sort of knew from his mind. I don't want this. Why me? I can't stand this any longer. That is like the mental stuff towards the pain. But the physical part is there. You can't really do much about that. We all have physical pain from time to time. But we don't need to make that into a mental pain. Understanding those two arrows means you can take out the mental arrow of pain. They're not wanting it. So, one way of practicing that, and I'm sure I'll say this many times on this retreat, a very simple meditation method which comes from that story in opening the door of your heart of the Emperor's Three Questions. Actually, I was looking at one of those stories the other day. I started reading it. It's not a bad book. Every now and again, you write it and you forget totally what it was about, and then you read it again. Ah, this is good fun. I only wanted to read one story and ended up reading quite a few. So, that Emperor's Three Questions, what is the most important time? Who is the most important person? What's the most important thing to do? You should know the answers to that by now. Now is the most important time. The most important person is the one right in front of you. The most important thing is to care. Simple answers. But I won't go into that story. But how you apply that to meditation is, what's the most important time? It's always the present moment. So it doesn't matter. You don't start thinking, I can't stand this pain any longer. You lost the present moment. You're standing it now. So forget about the future. Focus in this moment. And then there's a good chance, you know, that you come into this present moment, and much of the pain, the mental pain, is how long is this going to last for, disappears. And what's the most important meditation object? The one right in front of you right now. So if it's pain, That's your meditation object. Trying to get rid of it and thinking you should have some other meditation objects, that again is a mental error. Trying to get rid of something to get something else. Understandable, totally appreciated how difficult it is to be with the pain, but if you give it importance, it's teaching you something. Give it importance, the most important mental object is the one right in front of you right in this moment. And what should you do? Care for it. Caring, careful with what you have. So give it this beautiful softness. Thank you for coming to teach me. And then you find it's a beautiful technique of getting rid of the mental arrow of suffering. The physical arrow stays there, but it basically it's 90% of the pain is the mental part. I don't want this. That's one of the best. Dear Ajahn, in your instructions, I do your instructions, do nothing. You're not doing my instructions, you're doing something. You're doing my instructions, you're not doing nothing. Anyway, it works apparently. I don't even follow the breath, but my mind becomes bright. Is that correct? I don't follow step one until step four, I just do nothing. Excellent. Carry on. But make sure you don't write any more questions. Do nothing, okay? And don't complain. That's doing something. Dear Ajahn Brahm, I do not understand what a jhana is. Do you mind explaining? Thank you very much. Yes, I do mind explaining. I can't tell you what it is. Then you start faking it. So, sometimes... People are very good fakers. There was just one guy once. He was an amazing young man. He was just off the street. He was a street kid. And he came to stay at Bodhinyana a long time ago. And those days we had plenty of spaces. So, okay, out of compassion, you can stay here. And then after a few days, he started meditating. And he started telling people he was going into meditation for 4 or 5 hours at a time. And he really, he tricked Ajahn Jnana, Jnana Dhamma, he really thought this was an amazing meditator. And so, you know, we taught him, what do you experience? And he actually started talking about, you know, delightful breath and his incredible nimittas and even jhanas. And Ajahn Jnana was just so impressed, but I was a bit suspicious, I must admit, being truthful. And, you know, one day that somebody was passing his room and he was fast asleep, snoring. He wasn't meditating at all. And when we sort of checked up on him, he was just a street kid who got by in life by lying. He'd read my book, and he'd know all the stages, and it was amazing just how he could actually explain them just from what he got in his book. And he said that's how he got by in his life. And he was one of the best liars you could ever sort of expect. You know, he didn't sort of show much of the faults which most liars have. That's how he survived on the streets, nowhere to go. So, unfortunately, those days that people were very strict and said, okay, you've lied, you can't stay here. I think we should have really given him a bit more of a chance. But anyway, I'm sure he would have made a very, very good used car salesman or politician. He had just incredible ability to convince people of something which he knew nothing about. But it was because sometimes that if you give too many instructions and tell you all what jhanas are like, some people want them so badly that actually they construct them. And that's where I have to leave a few things out so that if I interview you, I can find out whether it really is a jhana or not, and not a fake one. And there's this woman I remember. When I told that story the other day at Bodhinyana Monastery, a famous story of me going to meet this monk Ajahn Tate and just having all these questions and has so much loving kindness, so much peace around in this monk that all my questions vanished totally. I just sat there just like a dummy but just so happy and peaceful. And anyway, that before I went in, there was this a Malaysian woman whose father was incredibly rich, and so she was giving lots of donations and so had lots of access. And she was telling this monk Ajahn Tate, she said, "Oh, you know, I got so still and my mind vanished, and that's fourth jhana, isn't it?" And Ajahn Tate said, "No, that's not fourth jhana." So she said, "Well, are you sure? Because this is what happened and that what happened." And he said, "No, it's not fourth jhana, it's just going to sleep." And he said, no, I was fully aware and I was very happy afterwards, that was fourth jhana, wasn't it?" And many times he said, "No." And then eventually, you know, she said, "But, you know, this happened and that happened," and went, "Ugh." And then she left with a big smile. "He's confirmed my fourth jhana." So sometimes people will ask you question after question after question. You say, no, many times. But then you go, "Ugh." I say, "Ah, that's confirmation." So sometimes people want these things so badly because of spiritual materialism that they sort of construct these things. So I don't really tell too much about what the jhanas are. So that when you come up to me and find out what you're saying, then I can actually understand what you've really got to, where you are. And it's not just what you say. There's many other little tricks. So remember, this is not to attain these things. Your job is just to let go as much as you can, to be as still as you possibly can. And then we'll see what happens. Why can't we eat in the evening? The answer is, why should you eat in the evening? What are the jhanas? Already mentioned. Why are there so many teddy bears displayed on your right? Because it's one of the meditation practices. I'm sure you've heard it before. It's called bear awareness. And that's what they're there for, to practice bear awareness. Now, one of the problems with meditators in today's world is they're too strict, too hard, forcing themselves too much. And so those are like metta bears, loving-kindness bears. So you've already seen a couple of people, they've been on retreats before, they're holding those bears, and they're in their lap, and they meditate with them. Thank you.
You can demonstrate.
Demonstrate, yeah. Oh, this is a nice one. So you put it in your lap, and you meditate with your hands there, like a nice posture. And you would think, "Oh, this is silly, you don't have to do this, I'm a serious meditator." Photo. But you will find with a bear on your lap when you're meditating, you have that softness, that kindness, which takes your meditation to a deeper level. It's a meditation device, a skillful means, which really helps you. And so I mention that now, so give it a try. And tomorrow evening you'll have all these questions like I usually have. "Ajahn Brahm, it works." Of course it works. That's why we've had them here. Some have been donated, some get taken away and replaced by other bears, but they are very effective meditation assistants. You try it. When you find that softens the mind, gives it a bit of peace and happiness and joy, and then everything gets very deep in meditation. It's a very good tool. Why do monks and nuns shave their heads? It reminds us of impermanence. Hair today, gone tomorrow. You deserve that stupid joke. It's renunciation. Look, it's really very difficult to have hair. It gets in your eyes, you have to brush it or comb it, wash it, and it's all going to depart from you anyway when you get old, so why not cut it off now? It's so much more convenient. I don't understand why people keep their hair. You have to have all different fashions, you have to dye it when it goes grey. Those of you who are conceited and worried about getting old. You have to sort of go to... How much did it cost to go to a hairdresser's as a woman? $20? $30? $40? $100? Wow! That could go to Jhana Grove instead. It doesn't cost a couple of cents, you know, to actually to shave it off. It's quicker, more convenient. You don't have to have any shampoo. When you're under the shower, just a bar of soap or whatever else you use. It's done all at the same time. And you never ever have a bad hair day. And it's fashionable now. You see so many people actually shave their hair. I know it's mostly men shave their hair, but women, you should demand equity. If men can shave their hair, why not women? So you demand your rights to shave. And we've got Mrs. Grumpy at the back, Ronnie. She shaved her the other day to raise funds for the Anukampa project over in England, making bikunis. Stand up, Ronnie. Doesn't she look so beautiful? Yeah. So who's next? But no, that's why we shave the hair. It's like simplicity, renunciation. Not really worrying about fashion and being beautiful. Sometimes people have long hair, short hair, and fashion's changed so much, and you're beyond fashion. So that's actually why we do that. And why we don't eat in the evenings is simplicity, so poor old Bianca doesn't have to keep cooking and cleaning up all day. Isn't it wonderful when you go back home? Actually, this is an indulgence here. Where I grew up, we only had one meal a day. Isn't that wonderful? Just one meal a day, so one piece of cooking, one piece of eating, one piece of washing up, and then you're done for the whole day. Isn't that freedom? So those of you who've got husbands you look after when you get back home, tell them from now on, darling, I'm only going to feed you once a day. You have as much as you like, but, you know, that's it. And why do you want to spend your life cooking and cleaning up for everybody? So it's much better to stuff once a time. Your humorous style brings so much levity and gladness in the Dhamma. Thank you. Were there instances where the Buddha displays a sense of humor? There was a couple of instances, but one of those instances is very hard to actually to check the humor sort of in ancient times to get. It's mostly play on words. But one of the funniest instances, it wasn't the Buddha, but one of his disciples. And it was an interesting anecdote because it gives you an understanding of what jhanas are and how rare they were in the time of the Buddha. When people say, oh, jhanas were already there before the Buddha, actually there weren't. For example, this was Chitta, who was actually a general in the army before he became a Buddhist and very well known in the district. And he went to see the leader of the Jains, Mahavira. It was a very strange thing. In the same area, the same time, two major religions had their founders and contemporaries, Mahavira of the Jains and Siddhartha Gautama. Mahavira was actually just centered around Nalanda, where the university was. And the Buddha was in many, many places, but same area. And so they were in competition. And so one day Chitta went to see Mahavira, and Chitta recognized this is a senior, well-known follower of the Buddha. And so he said to Chitta, he said, I've been hearing that your teacher, the Buddha, says that you can stop thinking in meditation. And he said to Chitta, do you believe that? And Chitta said, no, I don't believe that. And Mahavira, the leader of the Jains, was so happy. You see, I told you this is all nonsense, trying to stop thinking. It's just like putting your fist in the Ganges and stopping the current just with your fist. It can't be done. It's impossible. Thinking is just natural and normal. You cannot go beyond thinking. And see, even the Buddha's own disciple says he doesn't believe that. And then Chitta said, yes, Mahavira, I don't believe that, because I know it. There's a difference between believing and knowing, because I do it myself, I get jhanas. And Mahavira replied, these disciples of the Buddha are tricky and sneaky. You can't have a proper conversation with them. And that was, you know, a bit of fun and games, but it was also showing that one of the most famous contemporaries of the Buddha couldn't even comprehend how you could get into even first jhana when thinking all stops, let alone second jhanas. It wasn't well known in the time of the Buddha. And when the Buddha's own little funny stories, again with the Jains, they always copped it from the Buddha and his disciples. You know, it's just like, you know, the opposites. Like I was put down Oxford University because I went to Cambridge. And sometimes Australians always diss on Kiwis and opposite way around. I always remember that very wonderful quote from the New Zealand Prime Minister, Edward Lange. Because he was asked by the newspapers, are you concerned that all these people from New Zealand are going to Australia to get jobs? Are you concerned about the brain drain? It's not a brain drain, said the New Zealand Prime Minister. All those people who go from New Zealand to Australia is increasing the average IQ of both countries. And if you think about that, that was such a smart statement. You know, only the stupid New Zealanders, you know, go to Australia, with the exception of this monk. So the stupid ones leave, which means the average IQ goes up. But even the stupid Kiwis are much more intelligent than the average Australian. That's absolutely brilliant. You know, humor style, did the Buddha display a sense of humor? That he saw all these Jains, and they were standing on one leg for hours at a time, staring at the sun, starving themselves, because one of their tenets was you have to burn up all your bad karma. And so when people asked him about that, he said, well, yeah, you know, okay, fair enough. But it shows you how much bad karma the Jains have made. As for us Buddhists, we haven't made much bad karma. We're much better than they are. So that was, you know, a little bit of joking around. So yeah, there was a few times they used a bit of humour. And of course, the reason why we do use humour, this is not just myself, it was a part of the tradition I grew up with. Ajahn Chah was very humorous. So was one of my favourite monks. I went to see Ajahn Sing Tong. Here's one of the photos in the dining hall up there. For example, Ajahn Sing Tong. He was late for the morning meeting, and he was staying a student of Ajahn Mahabua, who was really strict. He was a small fellow, but he was just so terrifying to some monks, Ajahn Mahabua. And so this monk, his disciple, Sing Tong, he arrived late for the morning meeting. He slept in. So how can he get out of that? So being just a village boy, he went into the forest and caught a chicken, a rooster. You know, it's very easy to catch if you know, grew up in the forest, in the villages. He grabbed this poor old chicken and got a string, tied it round the chicken's neck, and dragged it to the meeting hall. This little chicken squawking and trying to escape, poor chicken, and this monk was dragging it to the hall. And when he got to the hall, he let it go, but you know, people saw that. And then after the meeting, Ajahn Mahabua said, you were late! Why? And he said, I wasn't late. I came before the chicken, which is Thai idiom to mean you got up really early. And all the monks burst out laughing, because he did, they saw him. He did come before the chicken. And Ajahn Mahabua just, I can't do anything with this monk, and just left him alone. But he's a very good monk. And for all of you who ever see me doing that chanting, sadhu, 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 am I breaking tradition? Not at all. Because Ajahn Singh Tong, when he gave the blessing, like, did the nuns give the blessing after the meal today? Did you? Yeah. You know one of the blessings we do, the Yata Wari Waha, do you do that one? Okay. But we do, if you go to Bodhinyana Monastery, Yata Wari Waha Pura Pari Parenti Sagarang, it's like a sharing of merit blessing. So this monk, he started, this is almost verbatim, almost exactly the same, Yata Wari Waha Pura Pari Parenti Sagarang Ewa Mewa Ito Dinang Peta Nang Upakapati Ichitang Patitang Tumhang Kipa Mewa Samijatu Sabe Parenti Sagapa. And I was a young monk, I just really wanted to laugh, but I didn't know whether that was appropriate. And I thought, this monk is crazy. But you know, he was an amazing monk. And he was unique in that even that, Ajahn Chah was the same, but most of those senior monks, people from Bangkok supported him. This monk was loved by all the villagers. Every day they would come. And also, now he did have a few senior monks from Bangkok came, and one day the senior monk, you know, was sitting above him, had more reins, and you know, they had a fish, you know, this little fish, the pla dot, and had a fish. And the senior monk from Bangkok, he broke off the head of the fish and put it in the spittoon and started eating the flesh. You know, you don't eat fish heads. And Ajahn Singh Tong looked at him, and right in front of him, took his fish, broke off the head, and ate the head and threw the body in the spittoon. Just a gem. You're being too picky and too fussy. He was a very, very funny monk. So sometimes being around some of these monks, it was very, very wise at times, but sometimes hilarious what they got up to. And you all know that Ajahn Chah story. I hope so. I love telling this story. Please, you've heard it before. I was in the back of a car with two other monks. Pabakaro, he was an American monk, and Gary, another American novice, just ordained. And Ajahn Chah was in the front, in the passenger seat, and the driver. And Ajahn Chah turned around, and he said to Gary, he said, "You're thinking of your girlfriend back in L.A., aren't you?" He did read minds. You know, there was psychic powers. He could do that. So, you know, I saw it myself. So poor old Gary, you know, his face went white, totally embarrassed. He'd been busted, you know, by the great teacher. You've got to be very careful what you think of when you've got monks who can read your minds. But anyway, poor old Gary was caught out. And then Ajahn Chah was a very kind, compassionate monk. So he said, "I can help you on that. So, you know, it's a lot of suffering. So I can help you." And he said, "Next time you write to your girlfriend back in L.A., ask her to send something of hers, something personal, so that whenever you miss her, you can take it out, so you won't feel so lonely." And he asked through the interpreter, "You know, is that allowable? You know, to take maybe a lock of her hair, or maybe just a little bit of her dress, you know, with her scent on it. Is that allowable?" And I, yeah. And then Ajahn Chah elaborated. He said, "But no, don't get a lock of her hair. Don't get sort of a piece of her, something more personal than that. Ask her for a little bottle containing her shit. And whenever you miss her, take out the bottle and smell. Oh, that's that's my loved one back in L.A. Totally gross. But so funny. Because isn't that the case when you love someone? Don't you say to your loved one, "Darling, I love everything about you." Really? So that was living with Ajahn Chah. Sometimes that was unpredictable, really good fun. So I'm not breaking new ground. This is my training. How do we press the let and go button? Thanks. Just like in the computer, the delete button. My favourite button in the computer, delete. I always find out what that is first of all. Delete, 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 delete. So, one of the ways is, this is another training from Ajahn Chah, practical, really powerful. He said, whenever you give interviews to people, which is part of my life, you come and ask me all your questions. He said, you should visualize, pretend that you are a dustbin, a trash can. So when people come and tell you their problems on meditation or relationships or their life, be a trash can. They can put stuff in you, all their rubbish you can accept. But the most important part of the Buddhist trash can is to have a hole in the bottom. So you can you receive all their rubbish, but you keep none of it. It goes right the way through. So always be a trash can with a hole on the bottom. That is how to let go. You're kind, you listen, you respect, but you don't take anything back with you after you leave the counselling chair. Or criticism. Because this, when I was, say, reading Open the Door of Your Heart, I saw that in there. I said, oh, I haven't said that for years. It's a wonderful little teaching. He said, if somebody criticises you, how should you react? And he used a simile. If someone calls you a dog, look at your bottom to see if you have a tail. If you haven't got a tail, you're not a dog. End of problem. That's how you let go. Investigate and find the truth of the matter. So, little things like that, anecdotes, they were amusing, but they were just so helpful. Because they were funny, you remembered them. And so when somebody called me an idiot, have a look. Am I an idiot? If you can't find a tail, you're not a dog. So you don't just believe what people say and get upset and angry. Find out if it's right or not. And if you are an idiot, oh, say thank you. Thank you for helping. I never noticed that before. And that totally undermines the problem. That is ways of pressing the letting go button. And the other way, of course, being in the present moment, understanding what wanting is, and just leaving it alone. If you get what you want, then what happens? People have all these fantasies and dreams. When I win the lottery, then I'll be happy. When I get rid of my wife, then I'll be happy. Some people think like that. When my kids grow up, when this retreat ends, when I get enlightened, then I'll be happy. Do you know what enlightenment is? You think you're going to be happy? How many times do we do these things thinking that once we get there, then we'll be happy? And that is the myth of our life. Why not be happy now? Be eliminated, and then happiness is there. How to relax the idea of who I think I am and connection ownership of objects. Oh, you can contemplate, what do you own anyway? All of your investments in the stock market. Who knows what Mr. Trump is going to do? I was reading about the property bubble in Australia. Any moment now, that people won't be able to pay off what they owe the banks. The banks would all go bust. You'll have no money left, no jobs left. Even your pensions will be cut because the government can't afford to pay them. Who knows what Mr. Trump is going to do next? Even Mr. Trump doesn't know what he's going to do next. So we live in very interesting times. So it shows you don't own anything. I'm not trying to make you upset and worried, but it just shows you it's not secure. If you own it, you can depend upon it. You're owning your body. How long is it going to last? Look at the number of people in this room. What is it, maybe about 80 or 90? You've got the 60 on retreat and a few gate crashers. There's always some gate crashers. Never mind, you're welcome. So, of 80 people and the death rate in Australia, that means about, on average, and an average group of people, maybe about, I think, 1.5 of you are going to be dead by this time next year. That's statistics. So, which 1.5 is it going to be? And don't just look at the old people. Young people die as well. Your age. So who is going to be dead by this time next year? Is that going to be you? Who knows? But it could be me, more than likely. So, this is when you realize you don't control your life. Every day when you wake up, here you are again. How many more times are you going to wake up in the morning? How many more times are you going to be able to come on a beautiful retreat like this? How many more times are you going to have a nice, kind teacher who doesn't tell you off? When you deserve to be told off. But so sometimes you realize you can't control this life, you can't predict it. That's what Ajahn Chah kept on saying, is anicca, uncertain. If you owned it, you'd have some certainty. What that really does, it makes you understand that the only thing you do own... I remember that story of the man with four wives? I'm reading that one again in my old book. Once upon a time, there was a man. He had four wives. Crazy guy, but there you go. So, and he was about to die. And on his deathbed, he called his most recent wife, the fourth one, the one he just married late on in life. Really beautiful, gorgeous woman. And he said, "Darling, I love you so much." "I love you too," she said. And he said, "I'm going to die soon. And I'm thinking I'd be lonely without you. Will you come with me into death?" And she said, "What are you talking about? No way. Never been done before. I won't do that. But I'll tell you what I will do," she said. "I will say wonderful things about you at your funeral." "Is that all?" "Yeah, that's all." And so he's very upset, even though that because of who she was, she used to get him invited to these really great parties and events in the A-list, but she would not go with him into death. He was so broken-hearted. "You promise you'll go everywhere with me, you'll love me forever." "Yeah, but that doesn't count after death. I'm not going to go in the grave with you." And so, "Get out." And then he called in his next wife, his third wife. She was much older, but she was still very attractive. And actually, most people, and if they were going to sort of go, have any lust, it was for her rather than the newest wife. And so he asked her, said, "Darling, I still love you." She said, "Yes, I know that." And you know, she said, "I've made many things possible for you in this life." She said, "I know, thank you so much, darling. I'll be lonely after I die. Will you go with me into the grave? Will you die with me?" And she said, "No, I cannot, I will not die with you. Once you're dead, I'll go with your son." "What? I'm not even dead yet. And you're already telling me about adultery. You're going to live with my son? That is just disgusting. Get out of here, you hussy." And so, getting his second wife. And she was actually very old. And you know, but she'd actually been there for him all the time. Like the counselor, the helper, the one he could rely upon for good advice and support. And he said to her, "Darling, I really love you." He said, I love you too." And said, will you come into death with me? I'll be lonely without you." And she looked at him with real compassion and said, "If I could, I would, but I can't, so I won't." She said, "But what I will do, I'll come as far as your graveside. I'll be there, but I can't go any further. I'm sorry, I can't." "Get out," he said. And then he called in his first wife. He didn't know just how long he'd been married to her. She'd always been around. And she was old, not very well looked after. But she came in and said, "Darling, I'm about to die. And I'd be lonely without. The other three wives won't go with me. Will you go with me into death?" And she said, "Of course, darling. Wherever you go, I go with you. That's why my name is Mrs. Karma. As for your second wife, Mrs. Family, she's always there to help you, look after you, and give you good advice, but she can only go as far as your graveside. As for that third wife, Mrs. Wealth, when you die, it goes with your son. Inheritance. And the last wife you get in life is Mrs. Fame. You know, your reputation. I make it possible for you to go to A-list parties, but all I can do is say nice words about you at your funeral. That's all. So, all these things which you think you own, your fame, your wealth, even your family, you don't own those things. You have to leave them when you die. But your karma, you are the owner of your karma, heir to your karma. If you own anything, that's the only thing you own. So, if you want to make investments, sure investments, which any actions of Mr. Trump can never take away, good karma. Anyway, that's the old story of the man with four wives. Absolutely crazy, but nevertheless. You can't say these days, the woman with four husbands. But women are much more smart than to have more than one husband. Why is it only men have more than one wives? Because they're stupid, that's why. Why do you want more than one to look after? That's crazy. Today I slept for a couple of hours in the afternoon. I think it was because I had a big meal rather than other times. I need a big meal because I have the digestion of a bird. Food just passes through without being fully absorbed. I hope it doesn't pass through too quickly. What do you think? No, it's almost certainly it's because you're tired. Because after a while, digestion of a bird, but a bird doesn't have any possessions. I've often noticed, you see birds flying in the sky, they actually migrate. Birds in Australia go all the way to Singapore and to Thailand, they go all the way to Europe. But do those birds ever carry as much luggage as you brought to this retreat center? No way, you never see them with suitcases or backpacks. They just fly. So that idea of a bird is a beautiful simile, I always try to remember. Carrying only the weight of your wings, no suitcases, no bags. So, you needed a big meal because you have the digestion of a bird, but when you come on a retreat, you're not doing anything. You're not working, so you don't need much energy. It's like putting your car in the garage for 9 days. So after a while, you find you don't need to eat very much. So slow digestion doesn't really matter. Fast digestion doesn't really matter. You get enough energy just from the food you eat here. So that means after a while, you won't eat so much. And after a while, you won't be so tired because you're not doing very much. You catch up on your sleep. It's mostly, I think, because of tiredness. And you know, why are there so many bears? I already said that. Why can't we eat at night? What is jhana? This is totally different handwriting than what's before, but I've noticed this so often on these retreats. The same question by different people. What is happening? The synchronicity that people are tuning into one another. When they meditate, in the reading minds, you are subconsciously tuning into another person. It's happened so many times that same question from a different person. Can you kindly elaborate what you mean by put it down? When I do, my mind takes me for a joyride of thoughts of past and future without apparent cessation. You're putting one thing down and taking up another. When I try and focus my mind based on past meditation condition, I end up with meditator's headache. Please help. Okay, I was going to say more about this tomorrow, but when your mind takes you for a joyride,
It means you're letting it take you for a joyride. You're getting entangled in the mind. Maybe I will leave this for tomorrow, how to deal with thoughts, and especially how to disentangle yourself with all these fantasies and joyrides and past and future which people can indulge in all day and just get absolutely nowhere. And how you can let go without your mind just taking you for that joyride. I'll leave that for tomorrow, if I may. I have been meditating for over 10 years. Oh, you're just a beginner. I have attended over 10 retreats. I'm very peaceful with very mild thoughts, but never experienced even a tiny nimitta. I rarely go beyond 15 delightful breaths. Please guide me. It's a lot of times because one tries too hard. Because you try, whatever peace you have is unstable. Only lasts for a short few minutes, if that, or just 15 beautiful breaths. When you let go, things become very, very stable and peaceful. When you want, when you strive, you may get to a place, but it's so unstable it just falls apart again. To get the stability so the mind can just watch the breath effortlessly for a long period of time, you have to just let go. Let go of interfering. And then it just happens. And when it happens that way, the breath is delightful. You're just sitting there watching it, doing nothing. Just like when you're sitting on the beach, watching the waves come in, the waves go out. The waves come in, the waves come out. You don't own the waves. You don't try and get the waves to come in quicker or bigger or slower. You just let it go. And the reason why people can spend a long time just watching the waves, it's simple and it's peaceful. And it fills the mind up so you don't need to think of anything else. So little by little, follow these instructions and you surprise yourself. You can watch the breath for hours. No effort at all. Sometimes I used to wonder, why is it when I started meditating I couldn't watch the breath for a couple of seconds, but I could listen to some music for about 20 minutes without missing any note. Why was that? Because the music was enjoyable and I wasn't enjoying my breath. Once the breath becomes enjoyable, and I can just relax and just enjoy it. I don't have to need to put effort in. Just it pulls my mind into it. So once it becomes joyful, then of course no effort is needed at all. And that is when you can get into some deep meditations. I'll say more about that again later on, but there's only 5 minutes to go and there's lots of questions. How can meditation help reduce desire? Because you don't need anything, you don't want anything. Many of the people here, you will notice them at 10:30, 11 o'clock, they're meditating here and they know it's lunchtime, but they'd rather just sit here doing nothing than just go to have some lunch. That's how joyful the meditation becomes. Better than lunch, even though you know you're going to be hungry in the afternoon, your last chance to get food until tomorrow morning, nah, meditation's more enjoyable. So, this is one of the ways that we can notice that it does become joyful. Actually, where's that question gone again? And so, you see it reducing desire. When you're satisfied, then you don't want anything. Ever notice when you're really upset, that's when you want lots of stuff? A lot of times, desire is our response to suffering. That's when men who are not Buddhists, they go to the pub to drown their sorrows. Women go shopping. I know that's total stereotyping, but there is some truth to that. There was this guy who gave his wife plastic surgery. He took her credit cards and cut them all up. Plastic surgery. Okay. Not sure if it's an appropriate question. It was triggered by your mindful burglar. In the Abhidhammata Sangaha, sati is found only in Kusala Chitta, Pali Canon. So burglar is paying attention to do, so do hunters who kill, but it's not mindful. They teach mindfulness to soldiers in the army because it makes them better killers. It is mindfulness, can be black and white, karma. It can be used as bad karma. Usually, though, in Buddhism, we never have mindfulness alone. Remember, Ajahn Chah would always use satipanya, mindfulness with wisdom, never mindfulness alone. So, real mindfulness always includes the wisdom element of it. In which case it has to be the wholesome. But the way that mindfulness is used these days is any old way. As long as you're aware. That's why sometimes business people do mindfulness training. So they can make more money and outwit their competitors. So it's... But anyway, the whole purpose of that simile was to show you that if burglars can do that, why can't you? Come in and go quietly. If a lay person says alcohol, cigarettes for a living, can the monk or nun accept his or her dana? Yes. But no, not the cigarettes or the alcohol, but just, you know, the money which gets from that. Because it was interesting when, in one case, there was a thief who had actually stolen a cow and slaughtered it for the meat and was running away from the authorities, and she saw the bhikkhuni, Upalawana, in the forest sitting meditation. And he thought, and he was very, very impressed by the bhikkhuni, Upalawana, and so he took some of the meat, put it in a little bag, hung it on the tree, and said in a loud voice, because she was still meditating, "This is for any monk or nun who finds it," and then ran off. And she was just coming out of her meditation, heard that, so she took the gift, even though she knew it was stolen goods. She had psychic powers. And she was the one who took the gift in the morning, cooked it up, and she was many hundreds of kilometers away from where the Buddha was, and then she flew through the air to give it to the Buddha in the next morning. There's many, many interesting stuff about that story, but the point was she was accepting stolen goods. And the Buddha sort of praised her for that, because the karma of the thief was with the thief. And the Buddha, you know, looked at it in a different way, that a thief needed to make some good karma. And you should not take away the opportunity of a thief or a seller of alcohol making good karma. And I was also fascinated by the story I heard the first year when I went to Bangkok. I ordained in Bangkok. And people said in the notorious Patpong Road, where all the brothels were and the bars, I think, are they still there? Okay. That once a year they'd invite the monks to dana in Patpong Road. They clean everything up, you know, the women would dress modestly, and they give the monks, you know, their meal for the day, like a dana, and the monks would give them a blessing. And I was actually quite impressed. The monks weren't that snooty and that superior and prudish. They would not deny the people in that profession the opportunity one day a year to do good karma. And I thought that's actually something very beautiful in that. We're not going to criticize your profession or why you're doing that. That's another sort of argument altogether. This is a day you can make some good karma, and we're going to give you that opportunity. Dear Ajahn Brahm, I've been meditating daily for around 2 years. However, my mind is still crazy. It will not be still. At best, I may be present, focused on the breath for a few seconds. Then will wander off for minutes, continually thinking. I've tried many things. I've listened to your guidance. I think the problem may be is a deep craving for peace, as I have anxiety and OCD. And when I hear about the peace and happiness you get from meditation, I deeply desire it. I know this is unhelpful, but how can I let go of that desire? How can I become peaceful and enjoy the beautiful breath? Please help. Again, this is really on the talk tomorrow about how to stop the mind and get some real deep peace. Oh good, there's only a couple of questions left. Is there more energy in the shrine room than in own room? Better to meditate there then. The best energy, as some of you already know, is in the meditation hall at Bodhinyana Monastery down the road. So I see many of you, you've found that out. You know, just in the afternoon especially, just go and walk. It's only about a 15-minute walk over to Bodhinyana Monastery. You're allowed to go in there to meditate. And that's got some really strong energy, especially get towards the front. And everybody knows that now. There's some places we've been meditating there for over 30 years. So great meditations have happened in that hall. And it's built up a lot of good energy. And many people say it's so easy to meditate there. Sometimes, if you're lucky, you go to places where the Buddha meditated in India. And those places are wow. If you can't get deep meditation anywhere, you try some of those places where the Buddha actually meditated and sat. There's no doubt about that. And wow, that just really peaceful, so easily. It's got, the places do have energy. So that's why it's too far to go to India on this retreat, but you can just walk over to Bodhinyana and try it over there. See if it works. Because it does. We had somebody brought their Feng Shui master over some years ago. I was away somewhere. And so they told me afterwards, Feng Shui master walked right into that hall and said, wow, this place has got immense Feng Shui. I mean, really immense. Especially at the front. The back, not so much. But the front, wow. So, you know, he was a Feng Shui master. Knew nothing about meditation. Could actually feel energy there. Is leaving the body mean to ignore the bodily sensation to be in the space between the thoughts? It is actually, but not as much ignoring the bodily sensations, but the body sensations ignore you. In other words, you can't feel the body anymore, it vanishes. This is not that sort of hard to do. Even when you sleep, your body vanishes. But this is you keep your mindfulness. You can't feel your legs, your bottom, your head. You can't sort of smell, you close your eyes, those sights sort of just disappears, turns off. And after a while the body vanishes as well, and sound is just so distant. Five senses just disappear. So the body, which is defined by the five senses, actually just vanishes from you. People think that the five senses are there to protect the body, but no, I think the body is the place where the five senses can play around. So once the five senses stop, then your body disappears. Last question. Can do standing meditation in addition to sitting or walking meditation? My body's more relaxed when I'm doing standing meditation. Usually your legs start to really ache after a little while. It's a very difficult thing to do. But I know a group of people who can stand for, I think, an hour at a time. And they get so still. I've seen them myself. They're outside of Buckingham Palace. But do they get into jhanas? I don't think so. They're soldiers. But still they can train, and that's through willpower. Standing there while all these photographers, mostly Japanese, take their photographs. I think everyone does that these days. What was that joke about? There was a busload of Japanese tourists in New York and they got robbed and the police have got 10,000 photos of the suspect. That's a joke, okay. It's allowed to laugh, because click, 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 click. Okay, anyway. That is it for this evening, folks. So, I rushed the last few questions. Please excuse me, because it's getting a bit late for the first time. If I didn't answer your question appropriately, please forgive me. It's the bear's fault. Yes, yes, it agrees. And you can always ask it again tomorrow. But many of those questions will come up in the talks which come in the morning time, so especially the ones about how to meditate and get very peaceful and still and not get carried away with the thoughts. It's one of the biggest problems when people meditate. You have an easy solution, and when you crack that one, you can sit there and not a thought goes on in your mind. Wow, that's so nice. So that's it for this evening, folks. So three sadhus. Sadhu. 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 So these bears are easy to take. Just go and choose one. You can take it to your room with you if you wish to meditate there. And so the bears are very popular. It actually does work to meditate with a bear. It actually makes you more kind to yourself, more gentle. So give it a try. Experiment. And have a wonderful night and see you in the morning if you're not one of those 1.5 people who are going to die this year. No. I forbid you from dying on this retreat. Because if you die, it's just really a pain in the butt trying to call the police and your family and members. And you know, I already do enough work. So I ask people, please don't die when you want to die. You know, have some consideration for others, okay? So wait till you go home, then you can die as much as you want. Okie dokie. Oops. So you don't have to wait for me. It's going to take me a while to get this thing off my head. I got it off easy this morning. I must have got a bigger head today.
Your teddy bear, you want one?
Bora, do you want that lady or me? Which one do you want? Okay. Blind bear. Okay, good night everybody. See you in the morning.